Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. The Supreme Court nomination of Amy Coney Barrett has raised alarms about the future of healthcare and the Affordable Care Act. The New York Times reports that the ACA has withstood more than 60 votes to repeal it from Republican-controlled Congresses and two Supreme Court decisions. Well, the Supreme Court will hear arguments in a case challenging the constitutionality of the ACA on November 10th. If it is struck down, more than 20 million people will lose their health coverage, and that is a conservative estimate. 12 million people have already lost their employer-based health insurance because of COVID. Joining us to talk about the legacy of the ACA and what is at stake if the law is repealed is Trudy Lieberman. Trudy is a veteran journalist covering health care. She's an adjunct professor of public health at the CUNY School of Public Health and a longtime contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review. Trudy Lieberman also blogs for the Health News Review and writes a bi-monthly column, Thinking About Health, for the Rural Health News Service. Her latest piece for the Center for Health Journalism is called Will the Supreme Court Whisk Us Back to the Bad Old Days When an Ear Infection Was a Pre-Existing Condition? Hi, Trudy. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. It's always good to be with you.
Well, it's always great to have you, Trudy. You know, we've seen a number of different numbers looking at the people who will lose their health care. I cited that 20 million number, and that's a conservative estimate. What is the number?
Well, I don't think we know exactly. We have some numbers from the Commonwealth Fund that have talked about if we keep increasing the infections, if they grow at about the rate of 45,000 new cases per day, that number will continue to add non-elderly adults to the ranks of the uninsured or the ones with pre-existing conditions, which in effect would make them uninsured if they have no other health care and the law goes down. So I think it's fair to say that there will be thousands and thousands of people, perhaps as many, you know, as 20,000, could be many more, who rely on the ACA right now for coverage because they have health problems that make them uninsurable in the individual health market. And that market is growing because the employer market is also changing. And that bodes not so well for the individual market, that as people lose their jobs with an employer who is providing health insurance, that sort of dumps them out there in the marketplace where they have to fend for themselves. And so they will go into the individual pool, so to speak. And if the law is struck down, they will have a difficult time getting insurance if they have any condition that the insurance company doesn't want to insure.
So all eyes are going to be on the Supreme Court when they hear this case on November 10th. Can you tell us more about this case?
Well, this is, I guess, the third challenge to the law. And this one has some of the experts kind of worried this time. And it's very simply put, that the Trump administration has argued that the entire ACA is invalid because in 2017, Congress eliminated the individual mandate. And remember that the individual mandate required almost all Americans to cover health insurance. Therefore, the ACA can no longer be considered a tax. And the Supreme Court in 2012 considered it a tax. And that's the basis on which they found the law constitutional. So that makes the law at risk. In addition, the administration has also argued that two other provisions are unconstitutional. One is community rating, and the other is requiring insurers to sell coverage to those with pre-existing conditions. And I think it's interesting to talk about community rating for a few minutes, because the ACA did provide some protections for people in terms of what rates insurers could charge. When the law was being passed, the insurance industry wanted to be able to charge people five times more, sick people, in older people 5 times more and than younger people. And the Congress decided that that was too steep a penalty, and they settled on they would allow the insurers to make old people pay 3 times more, which you can argue that that's still a lot of money if you're old and you don't have much income and you're buying in the individual market. But it still offered some protection. So that can go away if the law is unconstitutional.
So if they repeal the ACA, Trudy, how do you see this playing out? I mean, how quickly would people lose their health insurance?
I think that would depend on what the insurance companies do. I mean, they would be free to stop selling in that market to sick people probably right away, but many companies might not do that. Hopefully, they would be more humanitarian in their approach and either not do it or give a lot of leeway before they start cutting people off. But I think we really don't know. I think people are in jeopardy.
I mean, the timing just obviously couldn't be worse. We're dealing with COVID, the rise in unemployment, the rise in poverty, the rising cost of health care. I mean, there are just so many consequences here, Trudy.
Yeah, it's probably the worst possible time in American history, history of health insurance, to cut people off. I mean, people will really have no options. I have covered the individual market for a very long time in my very long career, and it's not a pretty place to be because you don't have any options. If you have the slightest condition, like an ear infection or a history of acne or something very, you know, relatively minor, the insurance company doesn't want you. And what they were doing in the bad old days was say, well, if you're getting, if you've had a condition that's bad, like pneumonia, they would quote rider you out, which meant that that's an insurance term. They would attach a rider to your policy, saying you have no coverage if you get pneumonia again, but also you may not have coverage for diseases of the lung, or even broader, you may not have coverage for diseases of the pulmonary system. So you might be out of luck. I mean, you might have all these problems or potential problems and never have coverage for them. And that's the real danger of going back to underwriting these people again for health conditions. It is really kind of barbaric to think about it. No other country that I know of does this sort of thing.
Mm. Well, I want to give out the phone number. If you have any questions or comments about the ACA and how you and your family and loved ones would be affected if it is repealed, give us a call and just let us know what your experience has been like with the ACA. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. I mean, at this time, there's so much need for healthcare, especially when you think about the people who are living with long-term health effects of COVID. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And we're speaking with Trudy Lieberman, a veteran journalist covering healthcare. Trudy, in your recent piece, you said one of the most important aspects of the ACA is that it requires insurers to sell coverage to people with pre-existing health conditions. And you write that provision has made it possible for the 54 million Americans under age 65 without other insurance to gain coverage for their underlying health problems and without paying astronomical premiums.
Well, that's been, I think, the major benefit of this law. These people were totally shut out of the market before the ACA was passed. And that is really what's at stake here. And people need to be aware of that they could lose this insurance very soon after an adverse decision is given by the court, if such a decision is rendered. I mean, we really don't know what they're going to do yet. But a lot of people are kind of worried about it. And one legal expert that I talked to said he thinks that the law is hanging on by a thread. So I think we're going to have to wait and see. But I think that it would be catastrophic for people to be, cast loose in the ocean, so to speak, because they're not going to be able to get coverage. And the thing that makes this even worse is that everyone now who's had COVID is likely to be uninsurable. We know, or we don't know, I guess, and we know some people have been having long-term effects from this disease, but we also don't know whether people will develop bad things happening to them 2 or 3 years after they've had the disease. I mean, nobody really knows. This is sort of uncharted territory. So the insurance companies know this too. And if you are an underwriter, and that's the person who decides on which people they want to insure or not, sitting there in the offices of some company saying, you know, this person may be too big a risk for us. We don't really know whether Mrs. Jones or Mr. Jones is going to develop some kind of serious post-COVID symptoms in 2 years or in 18 months. And do we really want to take a chance on that? And my guess is most of the companies won't. And the difficulty is if people, when they go through the underwriting process to get insurance, decide not to be honest about whether they've had the disease, that could be a terrible thing for them, because if the company ever finds out that they had the disease, they could cancel their policy, or if they have been in the hospital and have filed a claim, they won't pay it. So people would be really taking a big chance if they decide, well, I don't know whether I'm going to get sick. I've had it. I'm recovered, and I'm fine now, and say no on an application. And the company finds out about it, that could be very, very bad for them.
We had a caller during our COVID show a couple days ago say, if the ACA is repealed, there's a likely possibility that people might not get COVID tests because they don't want their health insurance company to know that they've been positive.
Well, I think that's a possibility. I think that would be a very bad public health outcome if that happens. But I can understand somebody who's on the margin of whether the symptoms are COVID symptoms or a common cold like I have right now. And you sort of say, well, you know, I'm not going to go for a test because I don't want this on my health record. I think that is perfectly understandable and might happen.
Trudy, we have an email from Aaron who says, assuming the worst at the Supreme Court, but also assuming that in January we have a new Democratic Congress, both chambers and a Democratic president, couldn't Congress reinstate the individual mandate and thus checkmate the Supreme Court defeat? The new mandate could even be nominal, couldn't it? Like a $10 penalty? That would reinstate the previous Supreme Court ruling, wouldn't it?
Well, I think that the Congress, assuming all the branches are in Democratic hands, could revisit this, assuming an adverse decision next spring, and that's when they expect the decision to come down, and try to repair the ACA. There are a lot of things that need to be fixed in it anyway, and many of these things that needed to be fixed have gone unfixed because the Republicans have not been interested in doing that. And so the Democrats haven't worked to make that happen. It was sort of a futile exercise in doing so. But potentially, if the Democrats win control of Congress and the presidency, that could happen, that the ACA would be revisited and this potential problem would be fixed. And there might even be other changes made. I know Biden has an agenda, a health agenda, that is more expansive, certainly, than the president's. And one of the things that he's talking about is allowing people age 60 and over to buy into Medicare. Mm-hmm. And that would go a long way of beginning to move toward a national health care system if people younger than 65 would be able to access Medicare.
Didn't he also say that dental and vision will be included for the first time?
I think I've heard him say that. It's also possible that Medicare would be improved. But Medicare itself has some long-term financial challenges, and I think they're going to have to deal with some of those regarding the Part A trust fund. And Part A is what pays for hospital bills for people over 65, and that is financed by the payroll tax. And I think people are kind of not aware of that, but those long-term challenges to that trust fund have been around for a long time, and Congress has not seen fit to deal with it. And so I think we don't know what's going to happen with that, and I would think that before they would add vision and dental, they would probably deal with making sure that hospital trust fund is up to snuff, because that would be really catastrophic if people didn't have hospital coverage.
We're speaking today with Trudy Lieberman, a veteran journalist covering healthcare, and we're talking about the future of the ACA. Thank you for the email, Aaron. You can email us yourcall@kalw.org, or you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to Lauren in Oakland. Hi, Lauren. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks. I hope this doesn't sound silly, but I've been so upset, you know, what being a news junkie about what's going on. And all of a sudden when you guys were talking, I thought kind of this Zen thing of, you know, if they abolish the ACA, there might be a silver lining in that people will be so up in arms that Congress will have to do something about, you know, a health care program. A national health care program, as she was saying. That's my comment.
All right. Well, thank you, Lauren. What are your thoughts about that, Trudy?
I think she may be correct. I think that the ACA, when the threat is upon it, that it may not exist and people need it and they've realized the value of it, even though the law is not perfect, I think that it could very well spur some kind of a movement toward a more expansive program, a national health insurance program, as the caller points out. And I think that I think that's on the mind of the people and the special interests that would oppose it, because there's been a lot of lobbying going on behind the scenes from the usual suspects and hospitals, doctors, insurance companies, and so forth, to make sure that doesn't happen. And I think if there's any whiff that could happen, we're going to see a whole huge lobbying attack on whatever is presented. But on the other side, the people who potentially are losing their coverage without anything to change it, you know, they might fight back, and there might be a groundswell of public support for this, as the caller suggests.
Very interesting. Well, thank you for that, Lauren. Let's go next to Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann.
Good morning. I wanted to comment for the umpteenth time, first of all, on the fact to please remember that Medicare covers not only seniors but people with disabilities. I'm a very happy Medicare beneficiary as a person with a disability. But I wanted to comment vis-a-vis today's show that it's my understanding that the argument upholding the mandate is more on the language than on the amount, meaning whether it was $5 or $5,000, the fact that it says shall in the clause means that it's a mandate, regardless of how much money is attached.
Trudy?
I don't know about the language. I just know the general framework that it tax versus the mandate. I think a legal person probably could answer that better. But I think your other point that you make is that, yes, sometimes we forget to talk about Medicare as being the health care provider for the nation's disabled individuals. And I think we do forget to talk about them. And I think that it's also instructive to point out that people who suffer a disability have a 2-year waiting period before they can actually get Medicare. I've always thought, as I've covered this part of the program, that that seemed rather barbaric, because people who have disabilities, or say they're injured at work or whatever, often lose their jobs, and they lose employer-provided coverage. So they're often stranded, and I've interviewed many people over the years in this predicament, and they always tell me, well, I have 18 months to go until I can get on Medicare. So I always ask them, what are you doing in the meantime? And they said, well, they're just making do the best they can. They're paying out of pocket if they get sick. So I would really like to see that provision go, as I'm sure most disabled Americans would also.
Trudy, what explains that two-year waiting period?
I don't know the history of that, actually, Rose. I just know it was in there when I started covering it and thought it was rather barbaric. But my guess is it was probably in there because these people were presumed to have pre-existing conditions if they were disabled. And if we let them in right away, perhaps they would mess up the risk pool because they would require health care. That's the only thing I can think of. That often, I mean, in regular insurance and commercial insurance, sometimes there used to be waiting periods for people who had pre-existing conditions, like a one-year waiting period or a two-year for specific conditions. So that may be part of the reason that it was a waiting period to make sure that a lot of sick people didn't flood into the risk pool.
Trudy, can we also spend a little bit of time talking about how the ACA actually changed healthcare plans? Because so many people had junk plans that really didn't do much. So how did the ACA change that?
Well, there were minimum benefits that had to be provided to people, and they were things like maternity care, vision, mental health. Those were big ones. Those kind of coverages, especially in California, were not included in a lot of individual market policies that existed before the ACA went into effect. And I remember one of the big carriers out there was providing maternity care, and the other carriers out there didn't like that because they thought that that was giving an edge. And it was a big hoo-ha about that. I think I wrote about it way back, you know, 25 years ago. But that's really what was going on. And the carrier that was providing the maternity care said, well, we really think this is a good benefit. We should be doing it. But the rest of the carriers in the state were not at the time. And so when the ACA came along, the ACA mandated certain benefits, and maternity care was one of them. And certainly mental health was one of them, and there were many others. And I think that if the ACA in total goes away, that, you know, I don't know whether those minimum benefits would go away with it. I think it depends on how broad the court decision is going to be, if it is an adverse decision. And I think that would be very catastrophic if any of the benefits that people get disappear. And in some ways, we have to remember they've already disappeared in some of these new policies that the Trump administration has been promoting. These new policies that a lot of people have been buying are very skimpy policies, very skimpy benefits, and they don't cover many of these things. And I think there have been lots of stories that my fellow reporters have done talking about people being confused about these some policies on the market that are not officially ACA policies. They're not marketplace policies. And so what happens is that the premiums are really low, and they're low because they don't provide very many benefits. And so, you know, people sign up. They say, well, I can afford this. And they don't always know what they're signing up for. And so I would think that if the ACA goes away and until something else replaces it that is good, we could see a lot more of that, I would like to call it the substandard market, but that's really not the official name. It's really a market that does not provide the same kind of coverage that an ACA policy provides.
And Trudy, we just found a piece by the New York Times in August. Major U.S. health insurers report big profits benefiting from the pandemic. Just a couple examples. Anthem's net income soared to $2.3 billion just in the second quarter from $1.1 billion last year. United Health reported net earnings of $6.7 billion compared to $3.4 billion for the same 3 months last year. I mean, these are huge profits, Trudy. What explains this?
Well, a lot of people weren't going to the doctor for other kinds of ailments. That explains part of it. And so they just had a lot of, you know, they didn't have a lot of claims. And so they didn't pay out a lot of money for people who were sick. And they were expecting that to change in the third quarter. And I haven't seen the third quarter results yet. I think probably seeing them in the next couple of weeks. But a lot of people I talked to, we did a story on the Center for Health Journalism site that dealt with this subject too. And the insurance companies were making out very well, and the hospitals, too, were doing very, very well. And they're continuing to do very well. I see hospital ads all the time, and in New York, some hospital system here has been told to advertise all the time and bring back volume to pre-COVID levels. But these hospitals are doing fine, some of them, and also the insurance companies are doing fine. And so I think it's going to be hard for them to cry poverty, for sure. But one thing that's happening, I think your listeners probably ought to be aware of, that we're likely to see on an ACA policy very high cost sharing going forward in the new crop of policies that you buy in this next open enrollment period that's coming up. That a lot of the insurers are trying to entice people in with low premiums, especially on certain policies. So they're trying to say, oh, you know, this premium is going to be really low, so come take it. But people need to be careful that that's just kind of a come-on, because there are really other elements of the policy that contribute to the overall cost. And one of them, of course, is the co-insurance deductible and co-payments that you pay, that those three elements are as important as the premium. And there's a trade-off. There's a trade-off if you want to go for a cheap premium, plan on paying a lot more if you get sick. If you buy a better policy and pay more up front, your costs when you get sick will be lower. And so people need to be aware of that trade-off, because that's how they're being priced. And a lot of insurance company actuaries have been telling me that they're loading the policies at the back end. So it won't be unusual to find deductibles of $15,000 or $18,000 on some policies. Wow. And very high cost-sharing for family policies that I would say is just not even insurance. That a family might have to pay upwards of $12,000 a year in out-of-pocket in order to get any coverage. So I think that it's going to be really tricky for people to shop in the individual market this year, because that's how they're pricing the policies.
That's just incredible. You know, we'll have you on, Trudy, after the election to talk more about how people can navigate this very... the system that is just so, has so many problems. One more question before we let you go. We talked about what would happen if the ACA is repealed and if Joe Biden wins and the Democrats have the House and the Senate, you know, they can come up with a new law. And Jim writes, if so, can it be written so as not to be chipped away at or destroyed by future courts?
I think any law can be written in a way that would make it foolproof, or bulletproof, if you want to call it that, to a court challenge. One thing that is important to remember, and I always remember this, while the ACA was going through the Senate Finance Committee, Max Baucus from Montana, who was chair of the committee, said, if I don't get Republicans to go along with this, this law is not going to be very permanent. And I remember thinking at the time, what is he talking about? You know, in my career, I've never heard anybody say that. You know, how can a law not be permanent? And as we've seen, as the Republicans have chipped away at this law, we've seen what Max Baucus meant when he walked out of his committee meeting one day and said that. And the press didn't pick it up. I'm sure I wrote about it for the Columbia Journalism Review, but nobody else really picked it up. And I think we see what's meant by that. And I think that the more they get bipartisan support on any kind of improvement legislation, the more permanent the change is going to be.
Mm. Well, Trudy, thank you as always for joining us, and we will definitely have you back after the election.
Thank you, Rose. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
You too. And we hope you feel better. That is Trudy Lieberman, a veteran journalist covering healthcare. You can find her latest piece for the Center for Health Journalism. It's called "Will the Supreme Court Whisk Us Back to the Bad Old Days When an Ear Infection Was a Pre-Existing Condition?" You can find that at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will speak with Kira Feldman, an investigative reporter at the Los Angeles Times. She wrote a piece that found California kept prison factories open as COVID spread. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about a Los Angeles Times investigation that found California kept prison factories open as COVID spread. Today's guest, Los Angeles Times investigative reporter Kira Feldman, writes, California's prison system has taken drastic measures to combat the virus, halting rehab programs, religious services, and educational classes. But correctional authorities kept one type of operation running, prison factories. Robbie Hall was one of thousands of incarcerated workers who stayed on the job in high-risk positions during the pandemic, making wages that ranged from 8 cents to a dollar an hour. They cooked the food, they walked from cell to cell delivering meals, they cleaned everything from communal showers to COVID units, and they labored in prison factories. Kira Feldman interviewed more than 30 people behind bars at the women's prison in Chino, California, and the Avenal State Prison for Men in Avenal, California. Some of the people she interviewed were infected with COVID. Hi, Kira. Thank you so much for writing this important piece, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What prompted this investigation?
Well, I saw, you know, some reporting out of New York that prison factories in New York were making hand sanitizer and face masks. And I just had a question, you know, what was the situation in California? You know, were factories open or not? And it was quite difficult to discover what was actually going on behind bars, because the communication with people inside is so difficult. But, you know, what I found was that the state prison system was making, you know, quite a big, you know, to-do about having, you know, producing, you know, what they were calling essential goods, like, you know, masks and, you know, hand sanitizer. But they were not advertising that they were doing things that are decidedly not essential, like producing, you know, furniture in a furniture factory in Avenal State Prison, which is one of the largest outbreaks of COVID-19 in the state of California. By now, 7 people in prison have died of COVID-19 at Avenal State Prison. You know, infections there among incarcerated people and staff have now passed 3,000. And, you know, for much of that time, the furniture factory at Avenal State Prison was open with, you know, men making, you know, masks, or I'm sorry, making, you know, desks and tables and chairs and that kind of thing. You know, these are goods that are sold for, you know, millions of dollars to state agencies in California. And, you know, what ended up happening was that the, you know, the men at Avenal State Prison, you know, the yard that staffs the prison, you know, now is 83% infected, or the yard that staffs the furniture factory, I'm sorry, is now 83% infected with COVID-19, you know, and, you know, this is very much, you know, seems to be related to the factory itself, where men co-mingled, they worked in close quarters, and, you know, they were threatened, you know, with discipline if they didn't continue working, even after one of the men in the factory tested positive and they'd all had been exposed. You know, if you get a write-up for, you know, this kind of discipline, if you, you know, don't do what your supervisor in your job and the factory tells you to do, this really affects your chances for parole. So basically they're being threatened with more time in prison if they don't, do what the supervisor tells them. And, that was the same situation for the mask factory at California Institution for Women, where Robbie Hall was working.
I mean, there have been a lot of pieces over the years about labor behind bars. Can you tell us more about how it works in California? As you write, the California Prison Industry Authority, a state agency, oversees about 7,000 people behind bars statewide. And they make everything from U.S. flags to license plates, and they sell these goods to the DMV, the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, the Department of Healthcare Services. Can you just tell us more about how this works and really who oversees all of this? Who makes the decisions?
Right. So there are basically two kinds of work behind bars in California state prisons. The main overseer of all of it is the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, of course. But CalPIA, the California Prison Industry Authority, oversees the factories. So the one type of labor is the type of labor that really keeps everything functioning inside of a prison. These prisons would not be able to run without incarcerated workers doing everything. They cook the food, they, do all the maintenance on the buildings, they even construct the new buildings that then confine them. They clean everything behind bars. It's really, the guards in prison provide, the security, but it is the people who are incarcerated who keep who make the prison function. And those kind of maintenance type operational jobs of, maintaining the prison functions, those wages start at 8 cents an hour and they go up to about 37 cents. So those are the lower form of paid jobs in California state prisons. The factories actually have a higher starting wage of 35 cents per hour. And that goes up to $1 per hour. Now, The labor is, by state law, any able-bodied, incarcerated person can be assigned to a job in prison, basically with or without their consent. That's the language in the state law. So the prison can take an incarcerated person's, preferences into account for these kinds of jobs, but they don't have to. And, once a person is assigned to a prison labor job, then it is not optional whatsoever. If failure to comply with directions once you're on the job, both, doing an operational job or within, prison factory job, failing to, work hard enough even is, subject to very serious discipline that will come up in a parole, board hearing. And, incarcerated people may find that their parole is denied because of a write-up that they got, 10 or 15 years ago for, refusing to work or participating in a strike. So workers behind bars are not considered employees by law, so they do not have the rights that a regular worker has. They cannot unionize. They don't get sick leave. They don't get unemployment. By law, they also cannot strike.
You spoke to Kate Chatfield, Director of Policy at the Justice Collaborative. This is an organization that advocates for criminal justice reform. And Kate said it is a bureaucratic decision to keep people working for pennies an hour during a pandemic. This should appall everyone who wants to live in a civilized society. Kate also told you that if these workers were paid a minimum wage, the system as it exists today would collapse.
Yes. So if you think about it, the prisons run, effectively on the cheap because they have these thousands of workers that do all of the daily work of, keeping the whole system running. And if they were paid, minimum wage instead of, 8 cents an hour, the system could not sustain itself. But, you also have to keep in mind that you have, thousands of jobs that are created by these prisons, both guards and also the prison factory supervisors and all of that. So the other part of the equation, I think some people are like, oh, well, they're not actually forced to work. Well, by law, actually the Constitution calls this slavery. You know, the 13th Amendment has banned slavery, quote, except as a punishment for a crime. So, by law, this actually is, slavery. And, this is something that, accomplished legal scholar, Professor Michelle Goodwin has, written on extensively, and spoke for the story on. But, a lot of these workers in, the prison factories, they use the language of slavery to describe their experience. They say, Robbie Hall said things like, it was like a slave factory. Other workers I talked to use that kind of language as well, saying, we worked like slaves. All they cared about was production, as they, did, 10 to 12 hour days, cranking out, masks in the sewing factory and working seven days per week, So while it is true that, workers, they do apply to get the, CalPIA, the factory jobs because of the higher, starting wages at 35 cents per hour, they are, they're very much sought after, but you really have to keep in mind that both, as many advocates and scholars have pointed out, that this is coerced labor because incarcerated people need money to do everything in prison. They need money for food because the food is, widely seen as unedible and rotten. You need money to make a phone call to your family, to send an email. It costs 26 cents per email to buy what they call a stamp. You have to work an hour in a factory to send a single email.
Yeah, that one, I was going to ask you about that. Sending an email costs 26 cents, and yet some of these workers are making 8 cents an hour.
Right. So, this came up definitely in the California Institution for Women, in the kitchen, and also, the women who clean the prisons and also pass out all of, the food and clean the showers and everything like that. So I talked with a number of those workers. Now, they don't work in the factories, but, this is still prison labor during the COVID era. And, they were working in the kitchen for 8 cents an hour. They were, cleaning their housing unit for 8 cents an hour. And so working in a kitchen is a very high risk position. You're elbow to elbow. Masking among the guards and what they call free staff is, widely described as extremely poor to non-existent. The kitchen at California Institution for Women has had numerous cases of COVID-19 among the, staff and incarcerated people there. But one thing that has been happening in the kitchen, I found from talking with, the workers, one worker told me, well, look, I was not sentenced to die behind bars. Like, I'm just trying to get out alive. But, she does not want to continue working in the kitchen and face all of this risk. But she can't, if she refuses to work, she will get a write-up, and that will lead almost certainly to more time in prison. The kind of the choices that the corrections department in California are making, in terms of infection control, both on the job in, these kitchens as well as in the factories, I found in my reporting are not sufficient. What they're doing is they're doing what epidemiologists call, commingling. They're bringing together workers into these, conditions like a kitchen, and these workers are coming from all these different housing units. So basically, it's the same situation, it was at least in, earlier in the pandemic when this led to the big outbreaks that I, tracked in my reporting. So you have all of these workers from different housing units, coming together and working these long hours in, a kitchen or in a prison factory, and then they go back, to their respective housing units. And, you know, this is increasing the risk of spreading COVID to, you know, throughout the prison. And that's certainly what happened in the sewing factory at California Institution for Women. You know, you had, you know, about 40 women.
Kira, can I just jump in here? We have only a couple minutes left, and I want to make sure you tell us the story about Robbie Hall. We're talking with Kira Feldman, an investigative reporter at the LA Times. You can read her piece, California Kept Prison Factories Open, Inmates Worked for Pennies an Hour as COVID Spread. Again, Kira spoke to 30 people behind bars. She did reach out to the heads of state agencies responsible for prison conditions, but officials responded through representatives. And if you read her piece, you can find out how they responded. But I did want you to tell the story about Robbie Hall, because as you report, Robbie stitched masks for 12 hours a day at the prison in Chino. For several weeks, she and other women said they churned out these masks by the thousands, but they were forbidden from wearing them. So first, why were they forbidden from wearing them? And then if you can just tell us a little bit about Robbie's story.
Right. So when the sewing factory at California Institution for Women, early in the spring, it went into mass production, like sewing factories in prisons across the state. You know, so they were doing, working 10 to 12 hour days. One prison that another was working 14-hour days, 7 days a week. And the prison system maintains that they provided masks to all of the workers upon when they started, but that does not seem to be the case. More than half a dozen workers told me that, when they began sewing the masks in the early spring, that they were forbidden from wearing the masks themselves and threatened with discipline if they, took a mask. Because there was it was just a bureaucratic decision made by the prison system of, well, these masks have to go to XYZ first. They have to go to, other people in the prison. Then they go to the older folks in the prison. Then they go to this and that, but not to the people who are actually making them. So it was a couple weeks, before everyone in the prison finally got masks, including the mask sewers themselves. Robbie Hall was one of these women sewing masks, and she's a really remarkable woman. She grew up in South LA. She's 58 years old, and she has been in prison since 1985. And this is she's serving a 15-year to life sentence, for murdering a man who raped her, and she said tried to kill her when she was 23 years old. And she has been denied parole, repeatedly. There are avenues for her to, challenge her conviction and make a habeas case, but, she can't afford to hire an attorney to do that. She's making 60 cents an hour. Many people in California state women prisons, she's Black. She's and she's also experienced sexual and physical abuse as a child. While she's been behind bars, her children have grown up. She has four kids, but actually while she's been in prison, two of her children have been killed. Her parents have died while she's been behind bars. Her surviving children have had children themselves and grandchildren, her daughter is, very much wanting to be reunited with the mother who, went into the prison system when, she was just 6 years old and she, was then bounced around between, the foster system.
Talking to Robbie Hall, are you able to keep in touch with her, for example? And will there be any consequences for her talking to you and sharing these stories?
Well, so far, I have not heard about any, retribution or punishment for her speaking out. I am able to keep in touch with her through JPay. Not all prisons have a kind of the JPay email system where you can, send emails back and forth You know, some of them you can only, you know, do phone calls, but, you know, California Institution for Women does have the paid, you know, 26 cents per email, JPay system. And, you know, she's actually, you know, many, many readers have reached out to me, you know, wanting to write to her and asking, you know, how they can help, how they can, you know, and so she's actually just a, you know, really remarkable person. And, you know, she says it's been like really rewarding to be able to share her story. And, you know, she thinks she has a lot to, you know, to teach the world about what she's gone through.
Wow. Well, it's really an incredible piece. And we'd love to have you back to find out, you know, how are California Democrats responding to this prison labor continuing under COVID? And so many people in prison got COVID. And sadly, many people have also died. So thank you so much for this piece, Kira, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kira Feldman is an investigative reporter with the Los Angeles Times, and you can find her piece, California Kept Prison Factories Open. Inmates like Robbie Hall worked for pennies an hour as COVID spread. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. You can find all of our past shows at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.